Welcome to part one of the Equity Guru Sixth Wave interview, where EG's own Chris Perry speaks with company CEO and founder, Dr. Jonathan Gluckman, to get a better view of Sixth Wave and where it's heading for the next 12 months. Listen in.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are not necessarily shared by people who are wrong.
Well, welcome to the Equity Guru interview series. Today we're talking to John Gluckman from Sixth Wave Innovations. SIXW is the ticker symbol on the CSE. John, how are you?
Fantastic, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sixth Wave has been around a little while. The story hasn't really got out there so much just yet. If you could give me the 30,000 foot view of what Sixth Wave Innovations is, for those that aren't familiar.
Sure. So we're a nanotechnology company that's focused on essentially grabbing molecules, whether it's for detection of substances or purification of substances. We do that at the molecular level using a technique called molecular imprinted polymers and other kinds of isolation techniques that are down at that molecular level. So from a scientific standpoint, the easy way I think I explain it is, you know, if you think about taking a soft piece of clay and pushing your thumb into it, you pull your thumb out and you've created an imprint in the clay then that has the size and shape of your thumb. And it has also those unique identifiers called fingerprints in the into the pocket now of the clay. And so that's an imprint. And so the only thumb that fits into that and has the fingerprint is your thumb. Well, all molecules have very similar characteristics to that. They all have a size and a shape, and then they have other things like a charge, you know, or chemical composition. So we can use that chemical composition to create an attractive force between our polymer and the molecule. And then we build our polymer around the molecule, we remove the molecule and leave a pocket just like that. So now we've got a force that wants to attract the molecule, and we've got a hole to make sure that any other molecules that are around can't fit into the hole, so they don't get captured by the polymer. That gives us a very efficient system, and it's because it's down at the molecular level that there isn't any better way to discriminate between molecules, and it allows us to do it rapidly and with great precision.
So an example of how it might be used is, say, in a gold tailings pond, when the gold mine has gone through and got all the easy stuff, there are still lots of bits in the waste, and your molecule might be able to be programmed to go in there and attract that gold dust out of the waste pop.
Yeah, so again, for us in gold mining, we have developed a product, our Ixos line of products, that's used in gold mining already. And in that case, we recapture the gold ions that are released in the gold mining process through the process of cyanidation. And so once you have a gold cyanide ion, we've imprinted for that. And we've shown that we're able to capture more gold, leave less in the tailings. We can recapture gold that is in the tailings, and we can do that down to a much lower left or resulting amount of gold left in those tailings than activated carbon is. And we can do it less expensively than using activated carbon. So that results in, you know, substantial savings for the gold mine, not just in cost, but it gets more gold for them, and that's what they sell. So they're very happy about that.
And what's the delivery vehicle for something like that? Like, you've got the molecules, but the molecules, presumably you're not just emptying a bucket of molecules.
Correct. So in gold mining, and even for our affinity systems for purification of the cannabinoids, we actually produce our polymer into a bead format. Okay. And so it just looks like, you know, if you think about polystyrene beads, you know, or your packing peanuts, these are really small beads. And they have a lot of surface area because they have holes all through them. And all along that surface area is the imprint for the molecules that we're getting. So in gold mining, of course, it's the metal ions. And in cannabis, it's cannabinoids. And so generally, these are all in a solution. So we take the solution, like the mining leach solution that has the gold in it, and we pass it across a bed of our beads. And the beads selectively take out the gold. Once they're filled to capacity, then we remove the gold using a process called elution, and then we directly electrowin that, which gives the gold mine back their solid doré. And again, in our affinity application for cannabinoids, it's very, very similar, almost identical. So here you've got a crude extract. We dilute that with ethanol and water. We pass it across our beads, and the beads collect all the cannabinoids, but they leave all of the stinky, smelly, horrible tasting stuff into the waste stream. And so we get a very high purity distillate just by capturing the cannabinoids.
Got it. So this seems like it has potential in a variety of different industries and sectors. Is the technology something that you have a patent on that you control?
Yes. In fact, the company has several issued patents already and patents pending in many different fields. So we've patented the processes and how to create molecular imprints for metals. We've done it for cannabinoids. We have a patent in for isolation and purification of hallucinogenics, which may be a new and up and coming medical application. And also we've done it for viruses. We have two patents pending, one for the fundamentals of creating molecular imprints for the identification and capture of viruses. And specifically, we're working in for COVID and influenza right now. And then we also have a patent in for different applications of that, which include things like breathalyzers or smart masks or lateral flow tests that use the molecular imprint, a completely a non-biological solution to do the virus detection. We're really excited about what that could mean for testing.
So that, I guess that application is less focused on COVID and more focused on the COVIDs to come.
Well, I would say that, but I think COVID's going to be with us for a little while longer, and so we're hoping to meet this challenge as well.
Okay.
But the thing about it is we've developed a process for creating essentially a virus mask. So we're creating the fingerprints for viruses. And we need a very limited amount of the virus actually to do that. And then once we have that, we can replicate them very simply. So think about what, before we had digital cameras, we all used film. A picture and created a negative. And once we've created that negative, we can make as many positive imprints then of the picture, or in this case, the virus, as we need. And so we don't have the same kinds of supply chain issues. We've created a completely artificial immune system, if you will, in the polymer. So the polymer acts like an antibody. And so we don't need to grow antibodies in, you know, bunnies and sacrifice in order to make, you know, immunoassay tests. We simply roll out long sheets of our polymer that are stamped with our imprint, and it's made chemically so that it has an attractive force for it. And of course, it can discriminate between any virus because all the viruses have a unique size and shape. And as we know with coronavirus, has those little spiky proteins on it, and that represents the fingerprints of the virus. So in concert with developing our COVID application, we're also working with influenza virus. And so we have the opportunity to do multiple detections in a single test, which is also unavailable right now.
So the option there is to, I guess, have a facility to detect that there's a virus in the air, is that it? Or to put it on front of PPE so that it attracts it and stops it from coming into you?
Be any of those things, and we filed patents for lots of those kinds of applications.
Okay.
So for point of care and point of care services, we think about a test that's very similar to what's on the market today, an ELISA test or other immunoassay tests, where they would collect a swab sample and then they would submit it. Except again, we don't have those supply chain issues associated with, you know, special swabs and reagents and all the rest of that, because we do the color detection right in the polymer. So that's one opportunity. But I think mostly we're moving toward something like a smart mask where we integrate our polymer right into the mask that you wear. And we can create either a color change to that or integrate it with an RFID tag so that once the mask is, you know, collecting 15 breaths per minute, so we get a lot of sample collection over a long period of time, that gives us very good sensitivity because we have more opportunities to collect a sample than an immunoassay would. And integrate this directly with RFID or with a QCR code if we go with colometrics, then we have an immediate reporting device as well. So think about putting on a mask or giving your child a mask to put on before they go to school. They get on the bus, they're wearing the mask, they get to school, and you know, they walk through the door to the school and there's a little RFID detector, kind of like what you see at every Best Buy that, you know, tries to detect whether you're stealing something. And okay, there's a monitor there and somebody's mask goes off, they know who just walked through, and they can send that child home, but everybody can be tested. Moreover, because we're not a biologic-based test, they could use that test over and over again. So maybe they only need to buy one mask a week, or they only need to buy a mask if they destroy the old one, dip it in water, or do something that would invalidate the test. Right. And that way we can get the cost of doing all of this kind of testing down to a point where I could afford it, sending my children to school, or a work could afford to provide these masks to their workers so that they could be tested every day before they enter the work facility. So they don't have to worry about widespread outbreaks at factories and other places where it's really impossible for people to effectively do their job and to isolate or separate properly.
So it seems like there's an abundance of potential uses for the technology. How does SixWave decide where it's going to apply its resources?
Sure. So theoretically, you know, you could do these molecular imprints for any molecule as long as it has a specific size and shape and fingerprint. There are usually ways to do that. What becomes more challenging is, can I make this in large quantities for an industrial application, say like a mask or for the gold mining situation? And so a lot of the patents that we've filed and that we've received patent protections for surround the idea of how do you take conceptually molecular imprints and actually get to a consumer product or get to something that's manufacturable. So, for example, we launched a set of products using MIPS to detect explosives. Well, obviously we couldn't put explosives into the polymer reactor. Nobody wanted to deal with a ton of RDX, say, making a polymer for us to make that product. So we had to learn how to engineer artificial molecules that would have the same effect as our explosive molecules. And the same thing happened in gold mining, right? It would cost us literally $4 million every time we wanted to make a batch of our beads if we had to use gold. Mm-hmm. So we had to find an artificial molecule to replicate that, and then we could manufacture it. So a lot of the work that we do up front before we decide to go after a market segment or a specific application is, hey, is there a competitive product out there? Are there problems with it? What's the commercial level? And then what's the target that this has to come in at as a cost and the size of a system? And can we meet that with a polymer design? So we do a lot of, you know, kind of rejection of the whole world of molecules, and we try and focus on areas like cannabis, like gold mining, like this virus, where it looks like there's a logical end to where current technology is, and starting to address it at the molecular level has that next generation effect.
You're listening to the Equity.Guru podcast with your host, Chris Perry.
Just a quick note to tell you, sorry to interrupt your interview, but if you want more of these, you need to go to your podcast player, whatever that podcast player is, and go and subscribe to the Equity Guru podcast. You can do that through iTunes. You can do it through Google Play. You can do it through all the places. Equity Guru podcast. Do it now.
Welcome back.
So SixWave recently announced that Nova Scotia's COVID-19 Response Council is giving $250,000 in non-dilutive funding to try and move your technology forward there. Does that get you to where you need to be, or do you need to put a lot more into it to get to product ready?
Well, we've been working on this and we've completed our phase one development work. So part of this funding, which we're really excited to have gotten. You know, it does a number of things. One, it helps boost our effort and it helps accelerate that. And we're moving now into the stages of working with the active virus to create those masks, as we were talking about a little earlier. And so our hope here is that with this funding and the funding that we have been dedicating already to this, sometime in the next 90 days, we ought to have demonstrable polymers that are actually collecting the coronavirus, isolating it, and that we're able to measure that effectively using electronics. And so working with the Nova Scotia Health Authority here and the pandemic response team will be doing testing, and they'll be providing us with additional, you know, non-monetary assistance in helping to identify the greater environmental concerns and making sure that as we finish the development of this, that we have a pathway to a certification with Health Canada and FDA.
It's, I guess, at a time when so many of us are wearing masks, just as a general rule, to be able to potentially put out a product that makes that mask a detection system, so that I can look in the mirror and think, oh crap, I've just been standing in the middle of a COVID cluster. That's kind of not just unique, but potentially takes away from the N95 market and makes it a six-wave market.
Well, so N95, you know, really was changing standard for dust collection so that it would keep you from inhaling dust and it's been adopted now here because of its particular filtration. But in several consultations that we've had with government officials, you know, they're equally interested in ensuring that we can put this into other mask types because, you know, as we've seen, you know, lots of people are working with cloth masks and all sorts of different masks that aren't N95. And from our perspective, there's nothing unique to the N95 mask that would assist us in the detection. So whether we're integrating it into N95 or we're providing it as an insert, for example, that could go into a cloth mask that, you know, has everybody's favorite sports team on it or whatnot, you know, we really don't care. So we see our technology having application and distribution partners that are wide ranging to make sure that we all have access to it.
Is the play to advance the tech and then commercialize it yourself, or is there a better play in advancing the tech to the point where you can just license it to a 3M or even be a takeover subject?
Right, and these are all business decisions that we're in the middle of contemplating. So we've already linked up here with one of the tier one auto manufacturers here in Halifax, a company called Neocon International. And they converted over some of their manufacturing facility to producing masks, both N95 non-compliant masks. And so we've teamed with them for initial integration of our technology into masks. Obviously, this is a really huge problem, and we would see that we would need multiple manufacturers going forward in order to meet demand. Whether we ultimately end up licensing that to a 3M or to other large manufacturers, or whether we simply, you know, white box manufacture for those and let them put on their logos, these are decisions that will be coming, you know, we'll be making in the next few months.
I tell you, if what you're putting together works, I can imagine every school district insisting that every kid be wearing them, or every large company handing them out to their employees. You know, sticking a swab up someone's nose and then waiting 3 days for the results to come out, it's not really an effective testing system at all.
You know, think about sporting events. Everybody wants to go back and start watching sports, and the teams don't want to have their outbreaks either. You know, there's quite a bit of infrastructure in that. And, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could all start going back to the hockey games and the football games and, you know, we just wear the mask, and when we get there, we've been tested. You know, you've worn the mask for 5, 10, 15 minutes. I've been able to collect 100 different breath samples and analyze them. And, you know, okay, you get in, you wear the mask on a continual basis, but you can go in with relative safety. We see the same thing with many of the entertainment industries. You know, we've been thinking for a long time about what is the impact for the cruise industry, for example. You know, here's an industry where we all know people that got stuck on the boats and the boats are out of commission, and how are they going to get back in? Very confined environment. Same thing with casinos and other, kinds of facilities like that. And this would provide a way not only for people to be tested when they come in, but think about all the ports of call, a ship wants to go to. Nobody wants the super spreaders to be coming off a ship. So not only could you test everybody as they enter the ship, but you could test them before they go to their port of call and when they return. So it provides a level of comfort with minimal intrusion, right? Yeah, no swab up the nose. Put a mask on for a few minutes.
Yeah, like even as you're standing in the line at the stadium to get into it, put the mask on at the beginning of the line and be checked at the end. It makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. Even these drive-by, test centers that we're all familiar with. So you get to the beginning of the parking lot, they give you a mask. And by the time you get to the end of the queue, it's detected or not detected. And there's no more swabbing and waiting for that test result before the next car can come in.
It's, what do you need to get to the place where that's a reality? Is it money raised? Is it time spent? Is it partnerships?
Well, we've developed most of the key partnerships that we need for getting the virus and allowing us to get to the imprint. And past that, it's really just a function of money. The better funded the company is, and that's part of the reason that we're in a bit of a raise right now, is to help accelerate this development and be able to have a demonstrable prototype in the next 6 to 8 months of something like the mask and a point of care test. And we're trying to do everything that we can to get this to people as quickly as we can. And really, from our perspective, the only holdback in time is cash.
So what are you raising at the moment to try and get to where you need to be?
So we have a price reservation out on a non-broker private placement for $3 million. We're into that raise already. So, what we need right now is about another $2.5 million over the next couple of weeks. Our work continues, and as that comes in, or if we are oversubscribed, then we'll be able to bring additional resources to bear to continue to accelerate the program.
So that raises at a slight discount to market where it is right now. You've been, over the last few months, there's been periods of immense buying and periods of selling off. What do you put either of those two sides to?
Well, intense buying kind of miffs me as much as anybody else. We haven't been able to attribute some specific actions. The company is on a very diligent course. We effectively went public and completed our RTO transaction in February, and then got socked with all the COVID stuff and market uncertainty there.
Right.
And so the good news is that we've been very successful about maintaining our business focus and moving toward revenue. And we'll be starting revenue generation in the December timeframe with our affinity units in the cannabis purification space. And we'll be taking that to cash flow positive toward the end of the first quarter of next year based on current sales orders. So that's really been our focus. And I think, we're trying to make sure that our announcements, speak not just to hype, which, there have been great temptations for hype in the COVID area and in the past in the cannabis area. Make sure that people understand that the company is very much focused on fundamentals, getting the revenue, launching products and being successful, and not just, a random set of science experiments. So
I'm hoping that... Let's talk about the cannabis space for a second, because there's definitely been a lot of motion towards beverages over the last year. I don't think anyone's really managed to figure out how to do it properly yet. It's primarily because the extraction process is you're extracting oil from cannabis, which makes it difficult to mix with water. Your technology, I'm guessing, goes a little differently. You'd be able to pull out the specific molecules that you're looking for, or the specific substances that you're looking for, without having to drag oil into it. Am I right there?
Yeah, so the oils that are extracted come out as part of the plant's oils. So from our perspective, in the cannabis space especially, you know, we find that the most prevalent extraction technology is supercritical CO2. Although there's cryogenic ethanol and some people are using cold water extractions, we really don't care. At the end, they get this crude material and it's, you know, it's like black tar. It smells horrible, it tastes horrible. So in order to get to the edibles market, the barrier has been, how do you get that purified into a very high purity distillate that maintains the cannabinoid varieties that were in the plants, right? Because we all know it's not just THC. It's THC plus the spectator cannabinoids plus the spectator terpenes sometimes. And that's what provides the uniqueness to a strain. And so that needs to be preserved. So what we're able to do is we're able to eliminate processes like winterization and distillation and go directly to just pulling out the cannabinoids and giving that back as a 95% distillate that's just cannabinoids. And the remains are probably small amounts of oil, which are very difficult to purify away because they're left in, you know, lines. You know, it's not that they were absorbed, but they're just around. But the next step of the process is usually the better edibles, they're doing something to help water solubility and solubility of the cannabinoids so that the absorption is more consistent in the body. Right, so nobody wants to drink a drink and have to wait 2.5 hours to feel something, yep, and then take the next drink and have it work in 45 minutes or not work at all. And that all has to do with how the cannabinoids are post-processed. What we give the licensed producer or the edibles producer is a way of going from that crude extract directly to a product that they can then do that final process, which is to increase that bioavailability and water solubility.
Thanks for listening. For disclosure statements and more info, please visit www.equity.guru.